Within the greater context of Ananda, let me start from this point of view. On the spiritual path, sometimes we tend to think of progress in a very linear sense, that you start here and you go there, and people are always looking around to see who's ahead of them and who's behind them, and we just have this very sort of moving in a direct line sort of way. That's the way the mind works, especially in the West, where our buildings are very square and our streets are square, and just sort of everything is linear in that sense. The truth of the spiritual path is more that we're working with concentric circles, or a circular path that spirals into a deeper and deeper point. And we do the same things again and again. It's just that we do them on a deeper and deeper level. I've been studying this teaching in one form or another since I was 18 years old, which is now, you know, does that approach? Well, golly, that comes like about 50 years, 40 years, 40 years of it. That's a long time. I went first from other teachings and then met Swamiji about 5 years into it when I was 22. But what's so astonishing to me is, like yesterday or this morning, some really fundamental concept, something that I've been hearing and reading about and have probably spoken with great authority about over and over again, suddenly appears in my mind like it was brand new, like I never even heard it before. I had this disconcerting experience repeatedly. In 1969, when I first met Swamiji, I immediately ordered a set of what was then called 14 Steps to Higher Awareness. It's now called Raja Yoga and comes out in a book, and it still is 14 lessons, essentially, in the spiritual path. Then it was a correspondence course, which you received every month, which I carefully put into this blue three-ring notebook, which I still have. And that was my course. Even though it's been made more beautiful, the essence is the same. So I would read it, and I would read it over and over. And many times over the course of the years, I would be asked to teach it, so I would go back and read it again. And I would make pencil notes of various kinds. So I could look 5 years later or 10 years later, I would find my own underlining and my own notes on paragraphs that I was certain were not in there when I read it before. Because if I had known that, why would I have lived the way I had lived all the time in between? Or it just meant something that I just was a stunning new idea. And I have a very, you know, I think, good mind for philosophy, but it would be a brand new idea, and the only explanation was I'd never seen it before. Well, of course, I had seen it before, but this world is not solid matter. We sit here, all of you are sitting, I'm standing on this floor, and in truth, this world is just energy. It's just vibrations of energy, but you don't fall through the chairs, and I don't fall through the floor, and we don't sort of merge into each other, and our brains don't flow out, you know, through our skulls. Everything is sort of held in place, even though in truth, there's nothing solid that would hold it in place. But what's holding it in place in the way this world is created, without being able to explain it really or wanting to take the time to, so I'll just quote people who say this, it's a matter of vibrations. It's the Holy Spirit, it's the Divine Mother, it's the Om vibration. These are all words for the same thing that manifests as energy and vibrates at a certain speed and dimension, whatever word you could attach to something that is beyond any of those words, in a certain way that results in the apparent manifestation of pretty much everything you see, including you and me. And all of our experience in this world has to do with meeting vibrations that match our own or vibrations that don't match our own. And far more than we realize, that's what it is we're responding to all the time, that we're on, people use words like we're really on the same wavelength. I felt so in tune with him. It was a perfect match. You know, all these words, what are we talking about that's matching? We're talking about the vibration of Om, which is the whole totality of creation, just coming together and merging in a certain way. That's what love at first sight is. That's falling in love when your baby is born, or finding your path, or being in a place you just know. There's this consistency of the vibrations. And when the vibrations are dissonant, there's not as much of an attraction to it. Now, What I've been thinking about a lot lately, and just, oh, I'm going to come to something else here. Within the context of concentric circles, which is where I was talking about, within the context of Ananda, people come, and there's a sort of a balance point between the total egalitarian nature of the spiritual path. If we are all manifestations of God, somebody can't be more God than somebody else. It just, we're all the one ocean. We may be waves of different shapes and different intensities and different sizes, but we're all one. So there's a great openness in our community about involving people. At the same time, it's only a fact, it's an obvious fact, that people live at different levels of commitment, and they have different destinies in their lives, and they choose sort of within the greater reality how to focus their particular energy. And even though we're not really big on really complex systems, we have a little bit of it. And one of the what that we have is we have the greater Sangha, the fellowship, which is just anybody who's involved. You can become a member of that Sangha, which is a light commitment, relatively speaking. Then you can become a member of what we call our sadhaka order, which is a lay order, so to speak, where people continue in their lives more or less as they are, but they have made the commitment that this is really the center point of my life. And then within that is something we call the sevaka order, which is people, which is monastic, not monastic in the sense of celibate, but monastic in the sense of I've joined the army. You know, now I will live this life, and I have the karmic freedom. It's not a question just of dedication, it's just having the karmic freedom, who you're married to, who your children are, what your career path might be, that allows you to say, I can say yes to what's ever asked of me because there's no other conditions in my life. So a certain amount of self-determination is given up in that sense. But within those two orders, the guiding principles are something called guidelines, used to be called rules, but now it's called guidelines for Ananda members or something like that. I went to look for it, but I couldn't find a copy. And within that, there are vows that the sadhakas and the sevakas take. And within those vows is the phrase, cooperative obedience. I pledge my cooperative obedience to those within Ananda who have been given the authority to help guide other people's lives. The responsibility is the word. And above all, that cooperative obedience is to the gurus, and the others act only on their behalf. Now, this is all a huge, long introduction to the other night at one of the sadhaka meetings. Somebody asked me the question. It was a very good question. How much obedience is enough? Right? What does this really mean? Now, it's a question that has been much discussed. I was amused because I watched in that very question, and I had to stop for a moment and think about what the answer to that was. And I realized, I said, really, that's not a question to ask me. That's a question to ask yourself. Because first of all, it's cooperative obedience, which says it's a two-way street. It's not anybody imposing on you, it's you making the decision that you want to cooperate with a certain reality. How much do you want to cooperate with God's will as it may be expressed through people you know and not just through yourself? What do you believe about your own ability to be a perfect instrument for intuition? Is there anyone in your life whose wisdom you have come to know and come to trust? Where is your commitment? How does God speak to you? And it's only that way that that question can be asked, only from direct experience. I laughed when I was thinking about it later because Swamiji has often said, once you start defining what it takes to be saved, because behind that question, as innocent as it was, that was the question. You know, give me the rules for salvation. But Swamiji says, as soon as you lay out the rules for salvation, the mind immediately says, how bad can I be and still get away with it? Right? Because isn't that what you're really asking? Because if you have a spontaneous draw towards something, you're not asking, you know, what do I have to do? What you ask is, how can I embrace this with my whole heart? And if you're only wanting to do what you have to do, sort of the minimum, not to go to hell, then the relationship is very, very different. This is how religion becomes dogmatic. You start answering that question, how much obedience is enough? Well, let's see, everything that has to do with food, you have to listen to us, but things that have to do with music, you don't. Things that have to do with transportation, you do. Things that with your children, if they're male children, yes. If they're female children, no. You just see the slippery slope you go down? Well, we have examples of it all around us, don't we? They're called churches, for the most part, or dogmatic religions, where somebody asked that question, how much do I have to give to God? And then somebody answered on some quantitative basis based on, well, probably a good intention, but misdirected. Because there really is nothing going on in spiritual life except the gradual refinement of one's own vibration so that that vibration will vibrate less in the separate consciousness of the ego and more in the expansive consciousness of the infinite. Because it's that ego that's really the problem, and even things like obedience, which are really old monastic ideas. Swamiji, when he first wrote that and even wrote the word obedience into it, there was like within, you have to realize that within the living memory of many people who are sitting around you in this sangha is the moment when these ideas were first articulated. You know, some of you walk in, some of you for the first time today, you have this impression that it exists. And of course, because so many churches do exist, one of the reasons we stopped calling ourselves a church, at least publicly, and went to the word sangha, which is, of course, most people don't even know. There's the obvious thought, why would you use the word people don't know? Swamiji was trying to make it worldwide, because in Europe, when we called ourselves a church, especially in Italy where we're centered, I mean, people would just look at us like, you're starting a church? How can you start a church? You know, this just is the Catholic Church, and that's simply it. It's like, and very few people can actually like cognize the reality of the fact that there was Jesus Christ, and then there were people, and then the people started the church, because the church tries to tell you that Jesus himself signed the mortgage papers on the first property at the Vatican. You know, it's just sort of like, that's the impression they try to give you, that he did it. He didn't do anything like that. He went through this universe vibrating in perfect attunement with the infinite, incarnated in a human body, which gave him the capacity to transfer that vibration to those of us who are trapped in, it gives him the capacity, it's by no means past, to transfer, to be the transfer station between that perfect vibration and the vibration that we're in, and we can try to find it. You know, I'm looking at Ramesha and Bhagavati here, and those of you who were here last night, it's especially true with Bhagavati because she plays the flute. This is the reason I would say it. Because she actually breathes into the instrument. And in some way, she breathes into that instrument, and then what comes out the other side is this vibration of music. And because she's trained herself magnificently to be perfectly in tune with that music, literally her breath will just make the music with a little intercession from her hands. But really what it is the breath makes the music. And I thought, what a perfect image that is of the powers of the masters, who the breath of their consciousness, everything about them, they have that, and then they breathe it out through the instrumentality, literally, of the form they've taken, so that we can see them. You know, the music, I recalled many years ago, Swamiji, many years ago, Swami had this record, 78 record player, that ran on a battery or the generator, and I don't know the name of the piece, but Jacqueline Dupré, who was this cellist, who just was such a gifted cellist, and she recorded some piece, and it was so exquisite. Often Swamiji would, in the evenings, we'd put that on, and we'd just listen to that one piece. It was just so gorgeous. Now, many of you may know, at a very young age, she became afflicted with MS, and her career was extremely short, because MS took away her capacity to use her body to channel the music. She was apparently an exceptional person, as you can tell from her music and from this little story I'm going to tell you. At some point, she was on some television show or something, and she was being interviewed, and you know how people are. Isn't it tragic that you can no longer play the music? And her response, I mean, of course it was tragic in many ways, and she answered from her highest level. I'm certain she had harder days than this one. But she looked just a little surprised. She said, no, the music is still inside of me. Now, what an answer that is. Because it had to have been in her, or else her mere hands would not have been able to put it across to us. Do You see what I mean? Because she had made her inner vibration one with the consciousness of the music that she played. Because nothing comes into form until it's into vibration. Now, all of this is about how you really walk the spiritual path. And what is it that we're really trying to do? There's this word that Master uses a lot, and we use it, but I've been really interested recently in miscommunication and how often people look right at each other and speak really clearly, and then they walk away and neither of them has any idea what the other actually said. It's interesting because Autobiography of a Yogi, which of course was Master's enormous contribution among many others, but this eternal contribution to the upliftment of mankind. And it's a short book, relatively speaking, when you think of the magnitude of what he had to say. So every little part of it is important. And one of the things he quotes his own guru as saying to him is this, and I wished I had read it and thought of it to read it exactly, but the essence of it is this. One of the things Sri Yukteswar tells Master you're going to have to learn, he says, is to hear what people really mean and not what they say. Now, you know, there's just so many things about the spiritual path, and you think of Sri Yukteswar being so elevated, but he says, people use words, but they're not really speaking. They're just trying to say. You have to develop the intuition to know what they actually really do mean, because that's where reality comes. Let me think where I was in a moment, just a moment. Oh, I was talking about attunement. There's this, I was going to say, sometimes people misunderstand that word attunement, and I've begun to see that in a lot of situations, people feel threatened by something that is actually only going to help them. And it's not really that it actually threatens them, it's just the words mean different things. That's where I was trying to go. Master, in many different places, there's one statement of Master's, he says, so-and-so left the path. It needn't have happened if he'd only been in tune, if he tried to be in tune. Swamiji writes in this little pamphlet called The New Dispensation, he says, even long, dedicated hours of meditation, Swami writes this, he said, after many years of observing people on this path, he said, I have seen that even those who dedicate long hours to meditation, he said, do not progress as quickly as those who as they would if they made a corresponding effort to be in tune. Okay, and that's a phrase that he's used a lot. And so this is where I wanted to talk about it. I tried to think, what really is that? Because people feel a protectiveness about what we call ourselves. But what we call ourselves, and this is what one of our readings today somewhere said, we're guided by the vibration of the ego and what feels comfortable to that. There was a period of time in my life, I remember, where I felt very inspired by what I was doing. It's so subtle. I felt very inspired. But as I gradually reflected on it, I realized that I felt so inspired because I had cut out all external influences and had walled myself within my own ego, and therefore, because I was only functioning within what I generated, there was no disharmony. Do you see what I mean? And so I was just moving along, thinking I was doing really great. That was one of these classic moments where Swami came up to me and he said, how are you, Asha? And there was just something in the way he asked. It made me nervous. I said, I don't know, how am I? He said, I'm concerned about you. And it was sort of like just in that instant, all of a sudden, the little shell I'd been building was penetrated. And it was penetrated by his loving concern for me. But when I allowed his vibration to enter me, it was dissonant with my ego. Oh, let me put it more accurately, my ego was dissonant with it, right? And then suddenly, because thank God, I am a sincere devotee, that ego which had felt so comfortable to me, suddenly I saw it for what it was. It was very out of tune. And it wasn't out of tune in a dogmatic, cosmic, you'll go to hell kind of out of tune. Well, all over for you, you know, to the other place with you. None of that. It was just the vibration of Swamiji, which is the vibration of Master, which is the vibration that my heart really longs for, is so much more attractive than this other whirlpool that just sucks me in every once in a while and convinces me that's where I want to be. It's just like I'm an adequate singer, and as years have passed, I've become even a decent singer at times. But leave me on my own, and my concept of what the melody is sometimes really original. You know, I just go out there and I'm singing along, and then vaguely I'll realize that this doesn't sound quite like what the others are singing. And then I come back into the choir and, oh yes, that's really much more beautiful than my version of it. It's not that I was evil over here. I just was out of tune. And how much we want to be in tune really just depends how much courage we have, what our karma is, how sick and tired we are of just being us. I often have, over the years, have taken seclusions, and I'm not really very good at short seclusions. I know people sometimes take 3 or 4 days. 3 or 4 days do not work for me. It takes me a minimum of 3 days, basically, to get rid of myself. For the first 3 days, it's just me, and it's just awful. You know, you're just there all by yourself. You're not talking. You're not entertaining yourself. You're just there with yourself. Oh, gee. And then at a certain point, she gives up. She goes away. And then for the next 5 or 6 or 10 days, whatever it is, it's just so blissful because there's no person in the same intense way. The vibration has been shaken off. Swamiji made a very interesting statement once. He was talking about how he was a very dynamic and promising person. His singing teacher thought he could be a world-renowned singer. Those who worked with him, with his playwright, thought that he was going to be a leading light in the American theater. When he was at school, W.H. Auden was one of his poetry teachers, and Auden thought that he had a magnificent future as a poet. I mean, these are just the things he happened to touch in on. And he was he had reason to be confident in his own sense of his own potential. But when he met Master, he saw in Master the happiness-producing vibration that he was really seeking. And it couldn't be quantified. You see, this is what makes it difficult. And you get people who pretend certain things. I read about a certain teacher. I don't mean to be rude, but this was one of my absolutely favorite lines. He said, "I used to meditate, now I'm just enlightened." I mean, it's not an inspiring vibration. But he saw in Master, you know, humility, kindness, and he saw all these things from reading autobiography and being face to face with him. We would all like to think that if we were face to face with Master, that would happen for us. When I first read Autobiography of a Yogi, I didn't finish it. I hardly read any of it. I couldn't meld. Just, you know, I read it and it just didn't go anywhere for me. I went in another direction. When I met Swami Kriyananda, literally, the instant I saw him, it was the distance it takes a person to walk from here to a third of the way into this church. And my vibration, I just recognized my vibration like that. And then, interestingly, I was able to pick up Autobiography and say, "This is terrific! Why didn't I like this before?" But something had to crack to make that match. So Swamiji himself said, "I never believed I would say these words to anyone. But the first words he spoke to Master were, 'I want to be your disciple.'" And that was it, because he saw that whatever it was that Master had, his very way of being in the world, that's what Swamiji was seeking. You know, in his own way, but not finding it, because your ego is the result of your vibrations. You see, attunement is underneath that. That's why to become in tune does not make you any less yourself. Because then you become in tune with these deeper vibrations, and then it manifests up through you, like this. So the way Swamiji described it was, he said, I merged my interests with those of my guru. And that whatever I was interested in doing, I was going to merge it first with his vibration and then let it express through me. And if we allow that to happen, then the master can change us. And that's why we say attunement is the grace of God. And that's why we say, that's why the scriptures say, you cannot realize God without the intercession of the guru. Because what the guru does is he harmonizes your vibrations. And that this also made an explanation for me of some little story that's about Swamiji, about advice Swamiji gave someone. This woman wrote to Swami, and she said, "Sir, I have an extremely important decision to make. It will determine the course of my life for years to come. No matter how much I pray to Master, I just can't get an answer. What should I do?" Swami's answer was so touching. He said, "Do anything you want. It doesn't matter." He said, "All the choices you've put in front of me, all of them are equally fine." He said, "All of them equally please Master, because what pleases Master is that you turn to him and then you asked." Because, you see, it's a matter of attunement. Do I just stand in my ego and try to, you know, keep it self-contained and then move according to my inspiration? Or do I say, "Lord, I'll do my best, but let the spirit that's moving me be yours." And then you develop this inner compass, which is much more profound than just a conscience. It's just this sense that if I do that, it brings me closer to the vibration of Master, brings me closer to the vibration of Spirit. If I go this way, it puts me subtly out of tune with it. And that's why the devotees say, it makes no difference if the whole world is against you. If your guru is pleased, that's all that matters. And what that means is, if your inner vibration is in harmony with the guru, then that's the instrument that's going to merge you back up into the spirit. And what you do actually makes very little difference as long as you stay in tune. Ananda, we say this and it sounds so confusing to people, because if it's in tune, we'll say, "Well, let's just do it and see if it feels in tune to do that." And if it's in tune, we can do anything. And if it's not in tune, basically, you just can't do it, because it moves you or the whole group out of that vibration. And that's not something that somebody can dogmatize. But that is something that collectively, and with help from those who have more experience than others, we can see how it works. It's not always obvious, but in the end, it's always true. Now, you know, this sermon has been sort of a thoughts from the journal. You know, this is like an ongoing reality. But it feels to me so fundamental and so important, and it was so much in my consciousness today, that I just really thought, let me sort of put it in front of all of you, because we're all brothers and sisters on this path. We're all doing this together. And the more collectively we can work and understand on the subtle level that these teachings are meant, the more powerfully the purpose of the fellowship will be fulfilled. Why do we come together? Why do we sing in a choir? Why do we try to make harmony? Because that one voice in the sounding board becomes more and more powerful. And also, if my candle dims and yours is brighter, you can show me the way. If I lose the note and the person next to me is singing strong, it will put me back on it. And Swamiji says, after the relationship with the guru, the second most important reality in human life is friendship. It's very interesting because, you know, there's some ways of thinking, oh, it doesn't really matter. This lasts eternally. These relationships that we have, the form changes. Everything in this world will disappear, the masters say, but not our connection to each other. The form of it will transform, but that vibratory harmony will bring us again and again with each other. This whole world is vibration, and if we are in tune with the master, through that we become in tune with one another, and the power that we have, well, it's a joy. It's our salvation. And it doesn't compare, doesn't begin to compare to the loneliness that we have without it. You know? This is why God has brought us together, and let us rejoice in that.